Hello, hello, and welcome to Historical Hysteria. It's been a hot minute, hasn't it? I don't really want or have any excuses to make. There was some work drama, then house drama involving psychotic breaks and some death threats. But I won't bore you with the details. I know why you're here. It's for me to tell you that Santa is secretly evil, and that he was invented by Coca-Cola. So, I mean, at best that would make him malevolently neutral, I guess. But let's jump right in today with the five Christmas myths to bore your friends and family with. I mean, excite. Excite your friends and family with. Starting with number five, Santa and Coca-Cola. One of my favorite Santa stories as a teenager was that Coca-Cola invented Red Santa. Before 1931, he was green. While this is partly true, before the 30s, Santa was sometimes green, but a red Santa dates back more than 300 years before Coke turned up. St. Nick's origins are pretty simple. He was a Greek bishop who died December 6th, 343, known for his generosity. His sainthood is a bit more complex, but we won't go too much into that. Santa is a bit different. Celebrations of St. Nicholas date back to his death. The first church to St. Nick was erected about 200 years after his death, and reverence of him spread throughout Europe. Celebrations of St. Nick usually involved generosity to the poor and children, though these were very much a pre-Christmas celebration, usually celebrated around the 6th of December. In the Low Countries, what is today the Netherlands and Belgium, St. Nick was especially popular. And over the Middle Ages, this evolved into the tradition of Sinterklaas. Briefly suppressed during the Reformation, Sinterklaas was a big bearded man who gave presents to children, wore a red robe and hat, and rode about town on a white horse with a black slave child named Zwarte Piet. So Santa was a red bishop with slaves? Not quite. This wasn't Santa per se. In 1804, a society in New York were trying to reinvent Christmas, and they settled on Sinterklaas as a good medium, and anglified him as Sancta Claus. New York's Dutch heritage meant there were plenty of Sinterklaas adherents still sticking about. American representation of this new Saint Nick began to take shape. At this point, they're largely black and white, so not red and jolly. Santa Claus and gift-giving become an American tradition over the coming decades, and there are cartoons of a Santa Claus, spelt Santa Claus, giving gifts to troops during the Civil War. Santa's colouring becomes even more confused during this period, as the American Santa Claus is coloured as yellow, brown, and of course, green. In 1868, an extremely drunk-looking Santa appeared wearing red and green, advertising sugar plums for the US Confection Company in New York. After this, Red Santa begins out-competing Yellow and Green Santa. The familiar red robe with fur linings also starts to take shape, and one of the most Santa Santas first appears on the cover of Puck magazine in 1902, flanked by two, let's call them lascivious women who are both kissing his rosy cheeks. Red Santa posed for Norman Rockwell, then brought gifts to troops in World War I, and then even went as far as Japan in 1914. Then in 1931, along came Hayden Sundblom, freshly commissioned to make a Christmas ad for who else but Coca-Cola. He chose a red-bearded jolly Santa. Coke churned out these Santa ads around the world year on year, and the image of Red Santa began to become fixed, not just in America, but globally. Coke likes to play into this myth a little bit, that they invented a new Santa. They even say on their website that they helped create new Santa as a figure of his own, rather than as a man dressed as Santa, which is a very generous interpretation of history. Really, what Coke can claim was helping to popularize Red Santa beyond America's borders and fix his image as it is today. But by 1931, it was already pretty fixed, even in Coca-Cola, because in fact, it was already so fixed. There's a myth within this myth here, because Sundblom, the Coca-Cola artist, wasn't the first person to make a fat red fur-lined Santa for Coca-Cola, who had been pushing ads with a similar Santa since the 1920s. But never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And that's how Santa went from a grim saint to an American god. Which brings us to myth number four about Christmas, religious Christmas. The religiosity of Christmas is hard to miss, even in the increasingly secular liberal democratic world. What with the Protestant reinvention of a Greek saint and supplanting the part about Jesus with a feast 3 weeks earlier about gift-giving? Did I say difficult? I meant extremely easy. It's extremely easy to miss the part where Christmas is still religious. Religion and Christmas have long had a funny relationship, but let's talk about the specific biblical elements. So if you paid attention in Sunday school or Wikipedia, you should know Christmas celebrates the birth of Christ. An angel appeared to Mary, knocked her up, Mary and the divinely cucked Joseph go to Bethlehem, three wise men turn up with some gifts, there's a star, little Tyke gets born, his circumcision goes to circle Jupiter, he fights some dragons, is eventually crucified around Easter. You haven't heard of those middle two? Now, most people, I think, know December 25th was possibly not Jesus' birthday. It was more likely chosen to make it easier to slot into pagan celebrations of the winter solstice as Christianity spread into Europe, which is also possibly why there are so many pagan elements to modern Christmas. The deeper myth here is one that slips under the radar. Why did Mary and Joseph go back to Bethlehem? Well, the Bible says, quote, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria, and all went to be taxed, every one into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child." End quote. See? It's simple. The Romans wanted everyone to go back to their place of birth so they could conduct a census. The Romans wanted to conduct a census, so said everyone in the empire has to go back to their birth town. What? What about people born in Rome? Or Britain? How would you even verify this in this period? Aside from making absolutely no sense, this will surprise you, there's no evidence of the Romans ever doing this. There was a census, but it was 12 years later, and people did not have to go to their birth towns. Also, Cyrenius wasn't governor of Syria under Augustus, so more likely, this has to do with a biblical prophecy that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. The story appears in the Gospel according to Luke, the craziest of the Gospels, by the way. So two explanations are given. Luke made a mistake. Luke, who was a native to the region. Luke, who would have just been able to ask literally anyone. Luke made a mistake. Or maybe someone later retconned in the story to better play into the Old Testament. I'm just saying. Don't crucify me. According to the scholars at Christianity Today, quote, "Friends, Mary and Joseph went to Bethlehem because it was God's will for Jesus to be born there. Some may not believe it, but God caused this to happen. Since God declared that Christ will come from Bethlehem, God would make it happen. His word never fails." End quote. And end accent. Compelling evidence there. Let's move on to myth number three. Basically, the entire rest of the nativity scene. The popular story of the nativity involves Mary riding a donkey, being given a room in a barn after an innkeeper turned them away. Jesus pops out, there's a star, three kings rock up, and a man is taking a poop in the corner. As we just talked about, Mary and Joseph had no real reason to go to Bethlehem, but we brushed past that already, so where do all the rest of these stories come from? Well, these all come from the Gospel according to Luke, again, the craziest gospel. Quote, "So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloth and placed him in a manger, because there was no guest room available to them." End quote. See, there's... Wait, where's the donkey? And the inn? Or the three kings? Well, the truth is, none of those are in the Gospels. Not even Cugna, the pooping man traditional to Catalonian nativity scenes. Three kings do appear in one Gospel, but they aren't kings. They're wise men, or magi, and they only appear in the Gospel according to Matthew, but not with a baby Jesus, but with a young infant Jesus. Their appearance as kings only kicks off in around the 12th century. This is also why the star is apocryphal. The star is biblical, but it is for the wise men who turn up years later. Also, there's no mention of three wise men, just that there was more than one. No guest rooms and manger. Well, a manger is a kind of trough animal, so that does kind of imply being turned away and sleeping in a barn or stable. But at the time, people often lived above their animals, so it could be just sleeping on the ground floor, or even someone could have just retrieved the manger for use by them. The story is full of... There's a lot of blank in that story that people then just filled in with whatever they wanted later on. Nativity scenes date back to the 4th century CE and evolve through the centuries. The addition of the ox and the donkey start appearing in art around the 12th century, though there are representations going back to the 5th century in Byzantine stoneworks. But regardless, almost all of the imagery we today associate with the nativity only starts to take shape after the first millennium. Which brings us to myth number two, a merry old Christmas, or as those pressed for time may call it, Xmas. Xmas is a modern abbreviation which is typical of the woke agenda secularizing Christmas for the Jewish agenda. Wait, I have the wrong notes here. So not many people stop to ask where the term Xmas comes from, but it's older than you may think, like ancient. In fact, there are records of the phrase Xmas or phrases like Xmas being used back to the 12th century, despite what the Church League of America said in 1957, calling it a secular Jewish plot. There's a more likely explanation for the origin: the Greek letter chi, which looks like an X and is the first letter in the Greek word for Christos, which is where we get the word Christ from. As in Christ, these fundamentalists are stupid. And X was a common symbol for Christ because of that, and still is. You might have seen on many Catholic Church symbols, there's a P with a big X through it. This is a Kairo, and symbolizes Christ, going back to the 3rd century AD. This isn't 100% given Xmas dates back over 1,000 years, it seems unlikely that people in medieval Europe renamed Christmas to appease some vague Jewish agenda for the Jew-controlled media? I don't know. If that wasn't obvious, I think this is the wrong podcast for you. But finally, we reach our number one myth. Oh, Tannenbaum, oh, Tannenbaum, the Xmas tree. People often say the Christmas tree was introduced by Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg in modern Germany, who brought the decorated evergreen to the UK after his marriage to Queen Victoria in 1840. This isn't quite true. Prince Albert was certainly instrumental in popularising the tree in the Anglophone world, but the confluence of English and German royalty dated back further than 1840. The first known Christmas trees were appearing in royal palaces in the UK from the 1800s thanks to Queen Charlotte. Weirdly, the Christmas tree arrived in America before Britain, though. Hessian mercenaries erected the trees, and sketches from early 19th century suggest it was already gaining some popularity in the young nation, which did have a large influx of German immigrants during this period. But say what you want about the Prince of Saxe-Coburg, he definitely helped popularize the Christmas tree first in Britain and then further around the world before it really got picked up by American cultural imperialism. Prince Albert, the first boom in popularity of the Christmas tree is thought to come from a drawing of the royal family celebrating Christmas with Prince Albert and Queen Victoria, celebrating Christmas in front of a Christmas tree with their young children. After this, Christmas trees have a huge boom in popularity and start appearing in gift magazines and suggestions for what to do for Christmas. This is really what is considered to have kicked off their massive popularity. But that is all we have time for today. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope wherever you are and whatever you believe in or don't believe in, you have a very good non-denominational holiday period and, of course, a very Merry Christmas. But before I leave, let me leave you with this. Gifts of time and love are surely the basic ingredients of a truly Merry Christmas. Peg Bracken. Bye.